These people live in a small village in South Vietnam. They're angry, they're afraid, they're confused. We don't know their names or the name of their village. It doesn't matter.
This is Panama, January 1964. These people are about to riot because an American flag has been raised in the canal zone, violating an agreement. They are angry and ugly.
We're going to have to decide whether we're going to die on the streets of the United States or in South Vietnam. I would choose the United States myself.
And this is Harlem. It could be Philadelphia or Jersey City. We heard this man or someone like him all year. It was his year of bloody riots and protest, more violent in the North than the South. It was a year when racial anger turned to aggression and destruction.
This is a group of young ladies standing outside the Plaza Hotel in New York City. The Beatles are inside, and with any kind of luck, one of them will look out of the window. One of them did. Vietnamese peasants crying out in fear and sorrow. That crowd in Panama. Some young ladies in front of the Plaza Hotel in New York City. It was that kind of year.
January 1st, 1964, came in with Chairman Khrushchev going to a party in Moscow and in what was described as a jovial mood, proposed a toast to peace. Archbishop Makarios of Cyprus broke his country's treaties with Britain. President Johnson promised continued support to South Vietnam. President de Gaulle spoke of European unity and understanding with the United States. And a number of Democratic county chairmen voted their choice for vice president. 185 for Senator Hubert Humphrey and 166 for Attorney General Robert Kennedy. On that day, Governor and Mrs. Rockefeller announced they were expecting a baby, and on January 3rd, the junior senator from Arizona made an announcement.
I want to tell you that I will seek the Republican presidential nomination, and I have decided to do this because of the principles in which I believe, and because I'm convinced that millions have
lost first in Wisconsin, and then lost in Nebraska, I think Mr. Stassi ran ahead of him there, but then proceeded to recoup in Oregon.
In 1964, these voices would almost drown out all the others, but not quite.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, amen.
In the ancient pasture land that stretches east from the Mediterranean across Israel to the Sea of Galilee lies a small village called Nazareth. It was here that Joseph lived with his wife Mary, and it was here that their son Jesus grew to manhood, laboring, at least so says tradition, as a carpenter. In January of this year, setting aside tradition, almost as old as Christianity itself, Paul VI, Pope of Rome, visited Nazareth and said Mass in the grotto beneath the lofty, gracious Church of the Annunciation. He was the first pope to visit the Holy Land since Peter. He was the first pope to fly. And in his meetings with Athenagoras I, Patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, other changes were hinted. A reunion of Rome with what the Church delicately calls the separated brethren. It was 3 days after Pope Paul returned to Rome. Panamanian students, responsive to their elders' discontent over traditional privileges accorded to Americans in the Canal Zone, marched to the Balboa High School in the zone and hoisted the Panamanian flag. They were within their rights. American students, in defiance of a year-old law, had neglected or declined to raise the Panamanian flag with the American flag, and feelings were hurt. It seems like a fairly modest dispute. It was not. Protest demonstrations grew and spread across the country. Troops were called. First rocks were thrown, then bullets fired. 23 people were killed, 350 wounded. And in one more place, in one more village street, there were voices raised against the Yankee villain. More posters, more slogans, and when it was over, another country where welcome had turned to toleration and courtesy was a thing pegged to the Yankee dollar. It was January, and already the year was old.
Hey, everybody, Mass Petita, come on. Hey,
But if much of the world was restive this year and sullen and resentful of the past, there was a certain gaiety here. The word is discotheque. It is difficult to define because it is many things, a kind of music, a kind of dance, the place where these dances are held, and the clothes that tradition demands. And of course, in this country, anything over 6 months old is automatically a tradition. The music is almost always on records, and the dances, based on the twist, now hopelessly out of date, are variously called the Froog, the Watusi, the Monkey, the Mashed Potato. All of these, with minor variations, are characterized by a kind of joyous agitation. Women's dresses for these folk rituals tend to be black, very straight, one strand of pearls, necklines low enough to embarrass the National Geographic. To join in one of these functions, one should be reasonably young and relatively free of inhibitions, whether economic, puritanic, or arthritic. Anthropologists disagree about the cultural significance of these festivals, and so we won't really find out until more facts are brought to hand or more anthropologists learn to dance.
That's all. Hey! Yeah, 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 yeah,
yeah. There are no casualties in Kodiak. There are no casualties in Kodiak.
The first shock hit at 5:36 on the evening of March 28th. It was massive. 25,000 square miles of the Alaskan Peninsula were virtually lifted from 3 to 8 feet. The Earth's core, responding to some deep and monumental imbalance, adjusted hugely. The first shock and the others that followed sent up ocean waves that raced across the Pacific and battered the coastlines of Midway and Hawaii and Japan. Earth tremors were felt in Houston, Texas. In Anchorage, there were buckled streets and shattered buildings. Kodiak and Seward were hard hit, and the casualty lists rose. The final count was 114 dead, including some in California who were victims of tidal waves set in motion by the shocks. Relief was immediate and efficient. Food and medicine flown in, shelters set up. Congress voted $50 million to help rebuild.
The city of Anchorage resumed commercial life today. Banks reopened except in the hard-hit central business district. Some employees of business firms began moving into temporary quarters, and automobile traffic began to clog the slushy streets.
And in this sullen year, a generous and gracious postscript. The Japanese, recalling the American aid that poured into that country after the Tokyo earthquake in 1923, donated $10,000 to help rebuild Alaska.
I am the greatest. You never know what I'm going to come up with. A movie star, a champ like me, just don't stop at one thing. You never know what you're going to hear when you tackle me.
This man's name is Cassius Clay. He's a prize fighter. At the time he issued the judgment we have just heard, it was generally agreed he was the second best heavyweight in the world. Well, he questioned this, and through the proper channels issued a challenge to the world champion, a sullen, fistic journeyman named Sonny Liston. Shortly before the contest, Clay predicted the outcome. Contrary to a practice long observed among professional fighters, he did it in verse.
Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back an inch farther, he'll end up in a ringside seat. Clay swings with a left. Clay swings with a right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight. Liston keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time, and Clay lowers the boom. Now Clay lands with a right. What a beautiful swing. And the punch raises the bear clear out of the ring. Yes, the crowd did not dream when they laid down their money that they would see a total eclipse of the sunny.
The fight took place at Miami Beach on the evening of February 25th. It didn't end quite as dramatically as Clay forecast. In fact, the whole encounter was fairly dull. Liston suffered an injury to his arm and failed to answer the bell for the eighth round, and Clay became champion. The receipts were $402,000, modest for a championship fight. To put it starkly, the giants in that sport have gone. This year, they sent boys to take their place.
And the year moved on. Bones, identified as being 1,700,000 years old, were found and said to be from an ancestor of the human race. A London clerk won $630,375.20 in a football pool. Spring came pretty much on schedule. The Chicago police, in a swift but somewhat delicate maneuver, arrested a young lady who appeared at a public beach in a topless bathing suit. She was asked, of course, why she did it.
The world is not ready for a bottomless swimsuit, but if a man has been wearing a topless swimsuit for so many years, why can't I?
In New York City, there was a World's Fair. President Johnson came to make a few remarks at the opening ceremonies. So did a number of civil rights demonstrators. The president spoke, and embarrassingly, the demonstrators demonstrated.
We do not try to disguise our imperfections or to cover up our failures. Rather, we freely admit them, and we bend our energy and our toil to correct them. I know.
It was very clear, very early, that the summer would be a rough one. Even if there had been no signs, the words spoken were clear enough.
1964 will probably see more violence here in America between the races than any other year has ever seen, primarily because the Negroes were fed up last year. But
this man calls himself Malcolm X, leaving off his last name, which is inappropriate. His last name is Little. He's the leader of a group called the Black Nationalists, an organization that maintains that only through violence can the Negro assert his rights.
But none of these things produced any results. So this year, the same Negroes, as soon as it gets warm, will be out in the street demonstrating. And it will build up and build up and build up, and there's no gimmick like the March on Washington.
It was spring in New York, forsythia blooming in Brooklyn's backyards, beachwear shown in Macy's windows, and already they were talking of a long, hot summer.
This happened to be New York, but this story had no dateline. 116 arrested in Atlanta in January, 90 arrested in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In Cleveland, 18,000 children boycott the schools protesting racial imbalance. White pupils in Macon County High School in Alabama boycott the schools because of the enrollment of 6 Negroes. On June 6, 50 are arrested in a demonstration in St. Augustine, Florida.
We must not approach the observance and enforcement of this law in a vengeful spirit. Its purpose is not to punish. Its purpose is not to divide, but to end divisions. Divisions which have lasted all...
It was July 2nd. After long debates in the House and Senate, Congress, by majorities of more than 2-1 in both houses, had passed the Civil Rights Bill, and the President has signed it into law.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
The law is crystal clear. It says that voting booths, classrooms, federally assisted programs, public parks, hotels, and other places serving the public shall be open to all members of the public on an equal basis. It was hoped, of course, that the passage of the bill would cool down the long, hot summer. It did not.
On July 16th, in the Yorkville section of New York, Police Lieutenant Thomas Gilligan shot and killed a 15-year-old Negro boy named James Powell. Gilligan said the boy pulled a knife on him. Two nights later, a protest meeting was held in Harlem. The final speaker, a Reverend Nelson C. Dukes, told the crowd it was time to stop talking and act. At Duke's urging, the crowd marched to a nearby police station to demand Gilligan be fired. The police set up barricades. There was a scuffle. This turned into a riot, and it spread through Central Harlem. Negroes threw bottles at the police. Orders to disperse were ignored, and huge crowds swarmed through the streets. Police, under attack from the mobs, fired over their heads. Many took advantage of the excitement to break display windows and loot the stores. Negro areas in Brooklyn rioted in sympathy, and there again there was the same pattern. Rocks and bottles thrown down from the rooftops, looting, and police gunfire.
Philadelphia was next, then Rochester, Jersey City, and responsible Negro leaders spoke out vigorously against the rioting. But for the first time, there was talk of backlash, a reaction against a reaction. There was no spokesman as such for this feeling, but there was speculation that it was widespread. There were those who said that the riots would cost Democratic votes and would win votes for a candidate strong enough to give it voice and meaning.
I sadly remind you tonight that we are seeing violence in those very states which are proving that new laws alone are not the answer.
Barry Goldwater, Republican senator from Arizona. He is vigorous, handsome, and conservative. 2 years earlier, a year earlier, those who said he would one day be a candidate for president were thought to be visionary and unrealistic. They were neither.
And then there is this above all, the oldest law of all. You can't pass a law that will make me like you or you like me.
On January 4th in Los Angeles, he said Rockefeller was more of a Democrat than a Republican, and so there was no sense in debating him. The next day, in a television interview, he said if elected, he would demand concessions from the Soviet Union by threatening to break diplomatic relations, and that he would break the nuclear test ban treaty if testing in the atmosphere appeared to be to our advantage. 4 days later, in New Hampshire, he said this country's long-range missiles were not reliable. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called that statement completely misleading, politically irresponsible, and damaging to the national security.
We must reassure in a more concrete way our allies in NATO that we mean what we say when we say we're coming to their assistance. And then we must equip them with modern weapons, and in my opinion, we must give the commander, this is General Lemnitzer, not commanders, not lieutenants and captains and majors, but the commander, more leeway in the use of these weapons should NATO or NATO countries ever be attacked.
Among Goldwater opponents, Republicans as well as Democrats, the phrase shooting from the hip came to be heard. On February 29th, Oklahoma's Republicans pledged their 22 convention votes to Goldwater. He lost in the New Hampshire primary, 33,007 write-in votes for Henry Cabot Lodge, to 20,692 for Goldwater. Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Goldwater's most energetic rival, got 19,504. But Goldwater won in Illinois and Texas, and the list began to grow. Victories in Indiana, Nebraska, though in Oregon he lost badly to Rockefeller.
The big test was California. It was victory for Goldwater, but a close one, 1,089,000 to Rockefeller's 1,030,000. But it was a victory. Rockefeller had lost more than just a primary, and he knew it. Goldwater was more cautious.
On the basis of the electronic computation so far, I seem to be the winner. I'm still somewhat of an old-fashioned conservative politician. I like to see them all totaled up the next morning.
Gentlemen, this has been a pretty exciting primary. Teetered back and forth all last night. And now I think that we can fairly say that the members of the Republican Party of California have spoken.
On June 19th, Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Bill. The convention was less than a month away. First, the preliminaries.
It was a tough debate. It almost got out of hand on several occasions. You must understand the temper of this group of people. There wasn't a mention of God in the first two sections.
This man's name is Silvio Cunny, a Republican representative from Massachusetts, a moderate, and a member of the platform committee. The committee meetings were secret, but Mr. Cunny's account of the proceedings was dramatic and revealing.
Very vicious. I was surprised. They couldn't even hide their feelings. They came out openly, especially some of the women who downgraded the immigrants in this country, said that our insane asylums are filled because of immigrants, that our welfare rolls are packed because of immigrants, that we have so many mentally retarded people because of immigrants. And this upset me no end, being the son of immigrant parents, first generation who came over here from Italy.
There were those who said that many of Goldwater's supporters were voting for him by default, that there simply weren't any other attractive candidates. General Eisenhower seemed to support Goldwater, but he also said he wanted an open convention. It simply wasn't clear how he felt.
I've come here to offer our party a real choice. I reject the echo we have thus far been handed.
On June 12th, rather late and rather tentative, and with an Eisenhower endorsement that was at once implied and denied, a new candidate announced himself, William Scranton, governor of Pennsylvania.
I come here to announce that I am a candidate for the presidency of the United States.
Goldwater graciously responded that he welcomed the candidacy of Governor Scranton. He called him Bill. He must have known that Bill would be no threat at the convention.
The Republican convention came to order quietly at 20 minutes after 10 Pacific time on the morning of July 13th. The scene was San Francisco in an auditorium called the Cow Palace. On the surface, at least, it all looked conventional and familiar. People wearing funny hats, regiments of reporters, music, cheering on cue. And behind the scenes, people speaking endlessly into telephones, as though, unless their elbows were bent, they couldn't open their mouths.
They must be overcome. And the Republican Party...
Governor Mark Hatfield of Oregon made the keynote address. Part of it was a plea for moderation. The delegates were responsive to Hatfield. He was not a candidate. But Governor Rockefeller was, and when his turn came to speak, it was clear how it would all come out.
During this year, I have crisscrossed this nation, fighting for these principles, fighting to keep the Republican Party the party, fighting to keep the Republican Party the party of all the people, and warning of the extremist threat, its danger to the party. Entitled to be heard for 5 minutes.
That's right.
Now, he can't be heard for 5 minutes if we're going to have these constant interruptions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is still a free country, ladies and gentlemen.
Even before the voting, it was apparent that the Goldwater forces had it all sewed up, and the balloting simply proved what was already known.
Rhode Island, 14 votes.
Mr. Chairman, Rhode Island, America's first vacation land, cast 11 votes for Governor Scranton, 3 votes for Senator Goldwater.
Rhode Island, 3, Goldwater, 11, Scranton.
South Carolina.
Clearly, it was Goldwater. It was the South Carolina vote that did it.
Mr. Chairman! Mr. Chairman! Mr. Chairman.
Delegates will be in order. Secretary will continue the call of the roll.
South Carolina, 16 votes.
Mr. Chairman, humbly grateful that we can do this for America, South Carolina cast 16 votes for Senator Barry Goldwater to put him over the top.
The next day, Representative William E. Miller of New York, Republican National Chairman, was nominated for the vice presidency. And only one question remained to be settled. How would Senator Goldwater go about gathering in the moderate Republicans who had worked against him? It's a problem that faces any candidate when the race is close. You could almost write the speech, "Now is the time to put behind us those disagreements which in the past have divided us and united in resolve and spirit." Senator Goldwater said something like that, but the sentence that everyone would remember was this.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.